Who pays for the future of Libya?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning from APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Jeremy Hobson. In his speech about Libya last night, President Obama told us the costs of efforts there will be shared with other countries. Well, this morning, representatives from more than 30 countries are meeting in London to talk about the future of Libya and who will pay for it. Let's go to Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London now as we continue our coverage of the economics of changes in North Africa. Stephen, what are they hoping to achieve at this meeting?
They're planning for a post-Gaddafi Libya, with the key question, what do we do with the Libyan leader? Put him on trial as a war criminal or bundle him off into a comfortable retirement? This may all sound a bit premature, but the summit is really trying to make sure that Libya doesn't suffer the same chaos that befell Iraq. And this will lead us inevitably into the subject of the job of rebuilding Libya after the conflict. A monumental task, says George Joffe of Cambridge University.
Libya requires an enormous range of material support. It needs to stabilize the whole distribution system. It needs to rebuild its infrastructure. And it needs, above all, to get its oil industry working again.
Some big costs for sure, Stephen. And I remember one of the things President Obama said last night in his speech, that some of that cost could be paid for with some of the Gaddafi money that's been frozen. Does that seem like a real possibility?
Well, there's certainly a lot of enthusiasm for that suggestion here, as well as a doubt that the frozen assets will be enough to pay for reconstruction. And there is an anxiety here in Europe, as in the US, that Libya in the short term, before it gets back on its feet, will need a lot of cash, and that we may be expected to stump up some of that cash when we can least afford it.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Jeremy.
To the state of Georgia now. This week, lawmakers there are considering letting grocery stores sell alcohol on Sundays. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Gene Bonner reports.
When the bill was first introduced, some supporters argued that allowing retailers to sell alcohol on Sunday could boost state sales tax revenue. Kenneth Hagany is Georgia's fiscal economist. He says the bill would have scant impact on state revenues.
The state gets about $169 million in alcohol tax per year. If we got 2 to 3% additional, I think that would be $3 to $4 to $5 million per year of additional revenue.
Which is not a lot when you're dealing with an annual budget of $18 billion. Similarly, grocery stores likely wouldn't see a big bump in sales because shoppers won't necessarily buy more alcohol just because they can buy it on Sunday. Then there's shifting consumer habits. Many working parents, especially mothers, say Sunday is the only day they can shop for the week. Amy Hillman is one of those working moms.
That's the time I can leisurely go through the grocery store, plan the week ahead, and if part of that is we want to pick up a bottle of wine for a dinner party, I should be able to do that.
If Georgia passes the bill, it would leave just Indiana and Connecticut with a ban on retail alcohol sales on Sunday. In Atlanta, I'm Jean Bonner for Marketplace.
And let's do the numbers. Global stocks are slightly lower this morning. eBay is buying a company called GSI, which helps businesses sell their products online. The $2.5 billion acquisition is all about competing with Amazon. On Wall Street yesterday, the Dow dropped 22 points to close at 12,197.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. By Mini, with 37 miles per gallon and 3 years or 36,000 miles of boot-to-bonnet maintenance. MiniUSA.com/info. And by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best. The Knowledge Effect.
Tangled. That's what we call Rapunzel now, and it comes out on DVD today. And Rapunzel is the latest to join the Disney Princesses, which translates roughly to a big money brand for Disney.
Welcome to the wonderful world of Disney Princess, where happily ever after happens every day.
Well, that brand is the subject of a new book called Cinderella Ate My Daughter. The author is Peggy Orenstein, who joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So first of all, when I was growing up, Disney Princesses didn't even exist. Now it's apparently a $4 billion business. How did that happen?
It was one guy's idea. His name is Andy Mooney, and he went to an ice show in Philadelphia, and he saw a bunch of little girls dressed as princesses and horrors, they were wearing homemade costumes that they had developed with their imaginations. That had to be stopped. That had to be licensed. And the first year that they put them out there, it was $300 million. And by 2009, yeah, we've hit a $4 billion a year business.
And does Disney have a lot of competitors here in trying to corner the princess market?
So they started this market, and then everybody else thought, woo, pink is the new gold, and they jumped on board. So now whether you're looking at like the guy who's selling a T-shirt on Etsy that's pink with a crown on it and says, give me the credit card and nobody gets hurt, or Mattel or McDonald's, or, you know, basically anything that can be pink and a crown slapped on it has been turned pink and a crown slapped on it.
All right. Now, when you think about all of the characters that little girls look up to and want to be like, I would think princesses would be like the least bad. But as you write, that's really not the case.
What happens with the princess culture is that it goes from being this sort of sweet, innocent, wand-waving thing to being about being the princess diva and the makeup, and the culture is telling them and encouraging them to define themselves from the outside in.
What would you say to parents who are listening to this and wondering whether they should be buying their daughters the Ariel and Belle gear that they see all over the TV and in the stores?
You can't keep the commercial ideas about femininity and the sexualization of girlhood out entirely. So your job is not to lock your daughter in a tower. Your job is to, when she's little, limit the choices. And that lays the groundwork so that as she grows older, you can really help her navigate through all of this to a true happily ever after.
Peggy Orenstein, author of Cinderella Ate My Daughter, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And there's more about the book at our big book blog at marketplace.org. By the way, the latest Disney princess film, Tangled, was the second most expensive movie ever made with a budget of $260 million. It has made Disney almost $600 million so far. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. And this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm sure you grew up being told to resist peer pressure, but it's not always a bad thing.
They try and get people to change their behavior, not by appealing to fear, but by giving them a new peer group to identify with.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Call it social pressure instead. See if that's better. The story next time on Marketplace from APM, American Public Media.